Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. To explain the origins of the Earth, people everywhere throughout time have devised creation myths. There are often great similarities among them as well. Judeo-Christian tradition holds that two people called Adam and Eve populated the Earth, and that a great flood later purged it. Many other traditions from around the world also have creation flood myths. People have always needed a way to explain phenomena they couldn't otherwise understand. Well, now we have science to do that, which is why scientists are looking back to more recent events in the Earth's history for guidance in understanding newer myths, myths that have some basis in fact. A cataclysmic event in Iceland 200 years ago had far-reaching consequences around the world. Only people didn't understand that at the time, so they developed their own explanations for what was happening around them. People like the Inuit of Alaska. In today's Soundprint, producer Dan Grossman visits Alaska to chart the course of one particular myth. He calls his program Fire and Ice.
The following is a weather bulletin issued by the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. A high wind warning is in effect today for Point Hope and vicinity. Northeast flow associated with strong high pressure over the Arctic Ocean has produced winds gusting to 55 miles per hour at Point Hope.
It's Thursday morning in Teller, Alaska, and Thomas Obluwalik and his uncle Norbert Kakarik are making plans to boat 50 miles inland.
There's going to be a bad storm.
So, what do you think, Uncle? Should we get the gas, or should we hold off a while, or what the weather? You know more about weather than I do. At the radio,
this kind of condition, Thomas, don't try to be short on gas.
I know that. I know my word.
Lots of guys make mistake by one can of gas short.
I know. I travel a lot.
Thomas and Norbert pay a lot of attention to the weather. They have to. They hunt and fish in the wilds of Alaska. And today they're going to the village where they were born and raised. It's a village that has its own history with the weather.
In the Eskimo calendar year, during the moon of April, the spring weather comes until May and June pass. After the birds of all kinds come to Alaska, the weather is cloudy and overcast. The wind turns into a northerly wind. The ground is exposed from the snow. The lakes have water. The rivers begin running and the creeks begin to flow. Then it turns into cold weather. Soon the water stops running and freezes over. Snow begins to fly. A big storm comes. In the Eskimo calendar year, in the month of June, the weather is cold and stormy. Snow is flying. The north wind is very strong. That big winter lasts from June until the next first of the year comes. That is April. It is 18 months of cold winter weather. They have only 2 months of spring weather, the months of May and June. People all over from Norton Sound up to the north cannot even go out hunting or fishing. Inland people all starve to death, except two at the upper end of Tuktsuk, three at Tsinuk, and two at Cape Darby.
This legend from Kuwerik Eskimo people chronicles the time summer didn't come, a year with two winters and no summer, a year of hunger. The tale follows a woman, Nupakuk, and her infant son, the lone survivors of starvation. It tells the story of a trek from a tiny coastal hamlet, 100 miles from present-day Nome, to safety.
Before she goes around the point, she stops and looks back toward the village where her husband lay, where she has buried him, and she weeps. After weeping, she said to herself, "He died, and he cannot help us anymore. Now I must try and go on my way to somewhere that I have not known. A new country might help to keep me from death and to keep us alive. I must go."
The story is a creation tale describing the rebirth of the Kuwerik people following the famine. Nupakuk and her child journey hundreds of miles by land and on ice floes in the Bering Sea. Finally, when the weather turns, they settle and start over again. That was generations ago. Now, like Thomas and Norbert, most of the Kuwerik tribe live in the town of Teller, an hour's drive from Nome. The legend of the year with two winters was one of the stories they heard growing up.
A lot of it is true, what they go through, especially about hunting and traveling and, you know, those kind of stuff. They're real.
Norbert says some legends are just stories, but this one really happened.
Our mother was telling us everything about it. She said that it was real hard for everybody. One summer, nobody had salmon hanging. They thought it was going to be summer right away, but the ice came in from the ocean and never really get warm. Everything was real bad that year. No salmon, no greens because the weather was too cold.
Right now, unofficially 57 degrees in downtown Nome at 11 minutes past 3 o'clock. For KNOM Update News, I'm Mike Nurse.
It's going to slow down tonight.
It's midday and the weather report is more promising.
So it seems like it's going to really die down by this evening. You heard it too, huh? Down, light and bearable, 10 miles an hour.
It seems like the storm will abate. But as Thomas and Norbert get ready to visit their old village, near where Nupacook and her son are said to have settled, they keep their ears tuned for news of any unexpected weather changes. 1,000 miles to the east, a scientist pulling a core from an ancient tree is looking for a weather report of a very different sort.
I'll core from this side first. We'll see what happens.
Just across the border between Alaska and the Yukon Territory, Gordon Jacoby is kneeling in front of a white spruce tree. This dirt-stained man is a leading dendrochronologist. He studies climate change by counting and measuring tree rings. Jacoby pulls a hollow steel auger from a holster and attaches a crossbar. He grasps the bar's two handles, places the auger's tip against the tree, and leans forward.
Getting it started is the hardest part of the coring operation. And then the teeth bite in after a few turns, and then it will draw itself and you don't have to push that much anymore.
Jacoby slowly rotates the corer, driving it deep into the trunk. The scientist has sampled trees like this throughout the Arctic. At high elevations and high latitudes, trees act like thermometers. Barely able to survive in these harsh habitats, trees respond dramatically to minute temperature shifts. When the auger reaches the center of the tree, Jacoby reverses the process and removes the tool from the wood. From the black core, he pulls out a pale yellow, soda straw-shaped plug of wood.
Actually, this tree, this is a beauty. This is probably almost 300 years old. I'll core this again because you can see I missed the center quite badly. There's probably another 10 or 20 rings. The center's probably out where my pinky is.
Each ring represents a year's growth. In this climate, thick rings mean a good or relatively warm year. Thin rings mean poor, frigid weather. By counting rings, Jacoby charts temperature for hundreds of years back into history. Jacoby pulls out another butter-colored core.
Okay, this one essentially I got the pith of the tree. That's the exact center of the tree. That's what you aim for. Under the right circumstances, you get the center, someone's supposed to buy you a beer. But I don't expect that's going to happen out here.
Jacoby says the Arctic climate is representative of Earth's overall temperature.
But see, there's the juvenile growth when the tree is just getting started. In fact, you can see the very, very fine growth for a long time. And here you're probably entering about the 1920s or 30s when the global warming took effect and you see these wider rings all the way out to the bark. And this is something that is evidence that you have indeed had a climate change. And it's showing that as a mature tree, it suddenly is doing much, much better.
Dendrochronologists can squeeze even more information from the thin pencils of wood they remove from trees like this one, like whether a summer was cool or warm. In Arctic climates, warm summers produce wood that is more dense. Not long ago, Jacoby published an unusual scientific paper about research using this technique. The project began with a colleague's offhand remark about legends of Alaska's native Inuit people.
Karen one time said, well, you know, there's a Inuit oral tradition that's been written down that describes an event several centuries ago where almost everybody died because of a really cold summer.
From his tree ring studies, he knew of an abnormally frigid summer, the year 1783.
And I knew this year 1783 because we'd worked on it. Also, some earlier dendrochronologists had noted that this was a very unusual ring in the Alaska, Northern Alaska series. And they just noticed it visibly, whereas we had actually done what they called density measurements of this particular ring. So therefore, my first thought was, this has to be the same year that it was super cold there, because according to the Inuit oral traditions, this disaster was unique in their records.
Seeking confirmation, Jacoby scrutinized the written legend. He re-examined wood samples, and he searched the records of the first white visitors to Northwest Alaska, Russian and European explorers.
They came here, or to Alaska, in the 1770s and made certain notes about villages and things. They came to Alaska in the 1790s and noticed a decrease in the population. And so they said there seems to be fewer people than there were. And so it all fit together that 1783, the trees recorded a temperature change. There was a legend of a lot of people dying because of no summer around this time, and the observations of the Russian explorers that there was a decrease in population.
Some anthropologists are skeptical that the year of no summer legend could have occurred in 1783. If it had, they say, the region would have been nearly empty when explorers came through in the mid-1800s. It wasn't. Jacoby says this inconsistency can be explained away. For instance, perhaps natives from elsewhere moved in after the weather-induced famine. He insists the theory is viable.
Angel.
20 miles outside Teller, the Eskimo travelers are taking a break from the frigid wind and pounding waves. The camp is a rustic tar paper shack. On one recent visit here, Norbert and his sister beat a hasty retreat after a close call with the grizzly.
Yeah, that bear was right over here, coming right straight for our cabin. And then he was hiding in those willows. They wait for 2 hours.
Uh-oh, I broke this thing.
Soon, they're on their way in the Arctic twilight. At this time of year, the sun sets here just for a couple of hours. Time seems suspended.
There's a white object right there by the brush line. Seagull, probably.
They're in a narrow passage with steep walls. Just ahead, the walls melt away and the straits become an inland sea. Winds whipping across its great length raise terrific waves.
White caps. White water. Big rollers. You need a tugboat. Oh, the cow arms that sail through here moons ago.
These were the ancestors who survived the year of two winters. Legend has it that the weather refugee Nupakuk passed this way as well.
God, look out here before the wind here.
Battered by whitecaps on the open waters, they follow the rules of survival passed down through the generations. Surviving in this kind of climate means you have to think ahead. Know how to read the signs of nature, the cycle of the year.
April and May and June, that's for spring time when you have your food for during the summer and early fall, and then late August, September, and October, you put your supplies for the rest of the year. And then like late October, November, and December, you don't have to really rush and put them away, but you always have to make sure they're covered. And then like December, January, and March, the snow is so deep. And a lot of times you dig a hole, if you have some gunny sacks or any kind of containers, you make a little hole and bury them with snow.
When we arrive at our destination, Thomas and Norbert beach the boat beneath a steep bank.
Want me to jump out?
No, we're okay.
What the bear tracks?
Hey, get the guns out.
Bear tracks right there. Fresh one, a while ago.
Have the guns out.
I got mine handy.
A grizzly bear is on the prowl. Thomas says the menacing tracks were left by a big one, perhaps a man-killer.
They're very fresh.
Gotta be careful. Let me...
The bear could be hiding in the tall grass above the bank. An accidental encounter could be deadly.
Nobody can go out alone.
Wait. Somebody grab a rifle.
You know how to use those kind of rifles, huh?
When Thomas and Norbert were young, bears didn't harass people here. Now, across much of the mostly emptied region, bears have practically taken over.
Make noise! Woo! Woo!
Is Thomas here?
Listen!
Norbert fires his rifle in the air to ward off the bear. Legend has it that before the Year of No Summer, the Kowarik people were also at odds with the animal kingdom, and the calamitous weather was divine punishment. But there's another explanation. It involves an event 4,000 miles to the east, in Iceland.
Around Mittmoan on Whitsun, June 8th of 1783, in clear and calm weather, a black haze of sand appeared to the north of the mountains nearest the farm of the Sida area. The cloud was so extensive that in short time it had spread over the entire Sida area and part of Fljótskvervi as well, and so thick that it caused darkness indoors and coated the earth so that tracks could be seen.
In the spring of 1783, the earth cracked open and lava spewed out of a fissure some 20 miles long. This volcano, known as the Laki eruption, exploded over and over in the following months. The Reverend Jón Steingrímsson was there.
Great slabs of rock and greensward were cast up indescribably high into the air, backwards and forwards, with great crashes, flares of fire and spouts of sand, smoke and fumes. Oh, how fearsome it was to look upon such tokens and manifestations of God's wrath.
The Laki eruption produced the second largest lava flow ever witnessed. 3 cubic miles of liquid rock poured out, enough to build the Great Wall of China a dozen times over. And more importantly for this story, 100 million tons of sulfur and toxic fluorine and chlorine gases spewed out. They rose above the clouds. Some floated right back down, killing vegetation and livestock. 1/4 of the island's inhabitants died from starvation or poisoning. Some of Laki's gases combined with water vapor in the air, forming a dense fog. The cloud was carried by high-altitude winds around the world. It touched down first in Europe.
The sun started to be seen as red glowing, and its shine was very weak.
Thorþór Dahrsson is an Icelandic volcanologist. For the last decade, the researcher, who presently works for a government agency in Australia, has been painstakingly documenting the local and global effects of the Laki eruption.
In some cases, actually, the fog was so dense that they didn't see the sun at all. A lot of trees lost their leaves in almost an instant. To a lot of people, apparently, in Europe, this was an indication of something terrible was happening and doomsday was approaching.
That winter, Europe, North America, and many other places in the Northern Hemisphere experienced record-breaking cold.
The straits between the Danish islands could not be crossed by boats because of ice. And you had 1 meter thick cover of snow in Denmark in late May, which is very unusual. You also had ice flows on the Mississippi River at New Orleans, which is a phenomenon that is unique in that region.
Gordon Jacoby believes the 1783 Laki eruption also brought on the Kowarik people's Year of No Summer in Alaska.
Our hypothesis is that these are the same events. We have the cause and the effect. The eruption of the Laki volcano caused a cooling, and this particular area was so cold, summer ended in early July, and this barred access to their usual food resources of these people, so they died from it.
Did Iceland's fire really cause Alaska's ice? Or could it be mere coincidence that 1783 marks the year both of Jacobi's unique tree ring and Iceland's pyrotechnics? At Reading University in England, Eleanor Highwood is seeking the answer using a climate model run on a supercomputer. The simulation attempts to replicate the effect of the Laki eruption on the global climate of the entire Northern Hemisphere.
We certainly were prompted to look at Alaska as a particular focus of the study because of Jacobi's theory concerning the cold temperatures and then leading to the Inuit problems with the Inuit population.
In her research on Laki, Highwood calculated temperatures throughout the Northern Hemisphere with and without the eruption.
And we do see quite a lot of temperature changes in the Northern Hemisphere. In particular, throughout the whole of June 1783 to February 1784, we see very cold temperatures, a difference of about 2 degrees Celsius over much of northeastern Canada.
Have you looked at Alaska?
Briefly, we've looked at Alaska. Interestingly, it doesn't look like there's a major cold spot in Alaska due to Laki in our simulation.
Highwood's computer model shows some evidence of cooling in Alaska after Laki, but not the frigid summer Gordon Jacobi has found. There could be a number of reasons why.
Either we have not got the circulation quite right in the right place, or we haven't got enough aerosol being blown into the right place, or alternatively, there are always problems with interpreting data from tree ring sources.
Are you saying that maybe the temperatures weren't so cold there after all?
It's possible. Tree rings from different parts of the globe show very different conditions in that time of year. The other problem is that Laki wasn't the only thing that was affecting climate in 1783. So there may have been cold temperatures in Alaska for reasons that were nothing to do with the Laki eruption. For example, there was an eruption of a Japanese volcano, Asama, which may have produced extra aerosol, and we can imagine that that would have been blown from Japan quite quickly over towards the western coasts of the USA.
Improvements to the model could help her sort out which explanation is correct. Scientists trying to fathom the human impact on climate need to understand natural forces first, including volcanoes.
So if we're looking at global warming effects in our climate models, we need to include the effects of volcanoes as well. If our work shows that those cold temperatures were due to this eruption, then that is a significant advance.
You guys coming?
Yeah.
There's some more bear scratchings and mama.
They're around here, Thomas.
After a sleepless night, Norbert and Thomas are surveying their clan's tin and tar paper homes. In the wee hours, they spied a man-sized bear, but it disappeared into a thicket.
Holy cow, look at the tracks out here. Whoa! Whoa!
Maybe he's around, huh?
Monster.
One or more grizzlies may be hiding in the waist-high grass. Even armed with two high-powered rifles, the Eskimos are jumpy and anxious to be on their way.
Jesus Christ! They ripped the tin, ripped the two, the lumber is ripped, and look, lived here.
One shack's nasty, jagged gash tells the story of a hungry bear in search of food. Other houses are deeply scored by bear claws. Thomas and Norbert are getting more and more nervous.
Worried. I'm a little on a jumpy side.
Yeah.
Because if there could be even a couple more laying down waiting for us.
There could be a couple more waiting downwind. The two travelers have done what they came for, to check on their family's property. It would be senseless to stay any longer with fearless bears lurking.
There's some more bear tracks on the opposite side of that.
Big ones. They're around. Like I said, they're here.
Okay, we're ready, huh?
The weather has broken as they begin the long journey home. Surviving out here, miles from a road or electric line, means knowing how to read tracks and other signs of nature, such as the shape of the moon.
I remember our grandfather told us if it stands straight up and down for a day or so, that shows we're going to have sunny days for 2 weeks or 10 days or so, something like that. But if it kind of leans to the south, like if it's a half a moon or a quarter moon and kind of lean to the south on the top side, that show there's lots of north wind, strong north wind. And then if it's kind of face up, the top of the moon kind of tips to facing the north and the bottom towards the south. That's lots of south wind and lots of wet weather coming.
Though their techniques are completely different, scientists like dendrochronologist Gordon Jacoby, volcanologist Thor Darson, and climate modeler Eleanor Highwood are also striving to understand and perhaps forecast the weather. It might seem surprising that the traditions of Alaska's Kuwerik and the scientific investigations of these researchers intersect. But if there's one thing climate researchers are learning, it's that the Earth is one system of cause and effect, where a disruption in one place can have far-flung repercussions. Benjamin Franklin may have been the first scientist to notice this fact when he postulated that a volcanic eruption, by blocking the sun's rays, caused cool weather thousands of miles away. The year was 1783. The volcano was Iceland's Laki outburst.
Fire and Ice was produced by Dan Grossman with production assistance from Laura Bland. Our readers were Half Thor Ingveson and Austin Imasuk. Special thanks to the Bering Straits Foundation, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and KNOM in Nome, Alaska. Some of our music was performed by Vince Picongana, John S. Penatek Sr., and David Alvana. This program originally aired as part of the special international collaboration, Global Perspectives, Nature in the Balance. You can find the rest of that series online at our website, soundprint.org. There are listening links, as well as links to lots of additional information, both online and on paper. The address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love hearing from you. Your feedback makes these collaborations and our regular programming better. So drop us a line at talkback@soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint can be purchased for a small fee. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES to order your favorite episodes. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. Next week on Soundprint, our Pole to Pole series continues as we study climate, geology, and life in some of the most distant and forbidding places on the planet. You'll hear tales of heroic travelers and explorers of the past and in-depth scientific research on the future of the planet. Don't miss our coverage of the International Polar Year coming this month and next on Soundprint. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.